So last lecture we looked at the length operator for an edge because having a concept of length is important when we have space of some kind. So we start from what would be like the ordinary length of a curve is just the integral along that curve of the tangent vectors and such. So what we want to do is replace that by a finite sum to approximate it as a length of a bunch of smaller edges. And so we do that using the fluxes here. And then we define the length operator on one of our, acting on one of our basis states that we had from before to be this sum of flux. So in some sense, this is sort of like a square root of the length operator in some way. So we want to be able to figure out what this is. And then after doing some calculations, we can write the fluxes in terms of so we have that, and then So we just put those in, and we do the calculations that we did in the lecture, and then we end up finding this more complicated expression. Except we find that this chunk here is really the Casimir operator for SU2, at least. And then so we use Schur's lemma, which in this case tells us that this is actually a constant times the identity operator, which is nice for us. And in fact, we find that this constant has a discrete spectrum. So it's, and this looks familiar from when we've worked with spins before. So what this tells us, and the important result, is that the length operator has a discrete spectrum. And in fact, if we put our units back because these, don't have our units, then this is actually the Planck length in 3D squared times. Yeah, so the important part is that we have a discrete spectrum of lengths that we can have for our edges. All right, and how many minutes do I have left? Okay, so and then completely separate from this, we have loop quantum cosmology. Well, not completely separate, but a little bit separated. So the very brief idea of what we can get from this is that we have, in general relativity, we have a homogeneous and isotropic metric, the FRW metric. And then so rather than doing loop quantum gravity and then trying to find something that's homogeneous and isotropic, we just assume that we have that first and then try to quantize that. And then this is sort of the idea of loop quantum cosmology in what we looked at least. So the important thing that we can get out of this is that Einstein equations have singularities. But what we can do in loop quantum cosmology is we can get our differential equation from what we have in ordinary GR becomes a finite difference equation. And in this case, we get for our n equals 0, this corresponds to the Big Bang. And what's important is we're allowed to have negative n, which tells us about stuff that happened before the Big Bang, in a sense. So we have a big bounce. And what actually happens at the Big Bang is that the size of the universe doesn't go to zero. It goes to some small size before expanding again. And yes, there was a lot more, but yes.
OK, thanks for that. Yes. So it's not that tree, now we have the big map, we have, instead of the big map, there is a big map. So there is no big map singularity, that is replaced by this big map.
One question, related to the big bounce, something that may be totally unrelated to what we're doing, but maybe it's a stupid question. But the fact that, okay, so we can go to negative n and in principle to minus infinity negative n.
Yeah.
We can trace down our history back to the big bounce, then go back to the big bounce. And
there is no big bounce, it's a big bounce, so it's just that now, so the
thank you.
So the picture with the Big Bang is that you have a starting time t equals zero for the history of the universe. So now what is the new picture is that you don't have, it's not starting at t equals zero. It's just that you, instead of this Big Bang, you have a big bounce, and then you go the picture, you can go later in time to time minus infinity. And then it was another contracting universe. Okay, if you go backward, or if you go,
another contracting
universe. Yeah. So the picture, instead of just having this singularity, something like this, and then an expanding universe, is that now you have something more like, and this part is replaced by where it's a size, at least the density is at the size of the Planck length, and then we have our universe.
But then. There's kind of no notion of primitive universe, right? Because they could just go backwards and backwards. And I kind of like having the problem reconciling the idea that you can just go back in time infinitely, and that moment actually happened, like physically, like. You know.
Yeah, it's just that a priori. So what? Everything has been here. So we don't really have access to what was before, okay? So the idea is that we just have access to what was here, but it's not just like the idea of the Big Bang was just a starting point. Then, of course, since we don't have access to what was before, we don't really know if it was just like this or many contracting, expanding, okay? And of course, nothing has been checked yet. So that's why there are some predictions from this model that hopefully one day will be checked, but it's a way to resolve this Big Bang singularity. Okay. It doesn't mean that it's a correct one for the moment. Okay. Okay, any other questions? So today we're going to go back to this Dirac program for 3D gravity. Okay. So what we have now from the previous lecture is that we have the kinematical, we quantized 1H. Okay, so we have. And we have used the holonomy basis of our Hilbert space, in which holonomies act as multiplication operators and the fluxes act as derivative. We have an inner product for a given edge, okay, given using the R measure for SU2. And we found an orthonormal basis, which is given by the matrix element of irreducible representation of SU2. Okay, so we have everything for one edge. So now the question is, of course, we are not interested in one edge. We want to look at the Hilbert space associated with a graph. Okay, so I'm just going to briefly give you what is the Hilbert space associated with a full graph, because we will need the full graph, because then the next step of the Dirac program is first to quantize the constraint, but then to solve them. Okay, and to solve them, we need something more complicated than just one edge of a graph. Okay, so we need to consider a full graph. And so today we're going to see that, and the quantization of the solving of the Gauss constraint. And tomorrow we will see. So tomorrow then it will be the flatness constraint. Then Wednesday I will talk briefly about the 4D case to tell you what are the differences and why it's not as simple as 3D, even if you know what it's not as simple. On Thursday I will briefly talk about the spin foam approach in 3D and 4D. And Friday, you will have guest lecture. So from Bianca, maybe Laurent, and some postdoc are going to come and tell you what they think are important today in the loop quantum gravity context. Okay? So this is a plan for this last week, so it's a busy one. Okay, so let's move to this kinematical Hilbert space of, so we want to define, if gamma is my graph, I want to define the Hilbert space associated with this graph. So we have seen that we have shifted the emphasizes from connection to holonomies. So this means that now instead of connection, you know that we are talking about holonomies associated to each edge of the graph. And this is what we call, in fact, it leads to the concept of generalized connection. So what is a generalized? So the name maybe is a bit misleading. Hold on. So what is a generalized connection? Definition, maybe I don't need. It's when we assign of a group element to any path E which belongs to our 2D surface here. So here, this means that the fundamental variable is really the holonomy itself and not its relationship to a smooth connection. Okay? So this is what. The algebra here of kinematical observable defined to be the algebra of the cylindrical function. Okay. So here we are talking kinematical is a so-called cylindrical function of generalized connection. So what is a connection, sorry. And we denote this by sil. And it's really the union of all the function associated to one given graph. So here it's for the union, it's for all graphs on your hypersurface. And so what is a cylindrical function? It's something which depends, of course, on your graph and on a function where f is a smooth function with f smooth function here on the group. Okay, so f is from SU2 and so this means that this object is going to be a functional of the connection defined as it's dependent on gamma on this function f, and we see that it's a function anyway on the connection, but we forgot about this by only taking considering the holonomy associated to each edge of your graph. And so you can see that as so the states here now for the Hilbert space, so the Hilbert space associated to a graph can be really seen as a tensor product of one edge Hilbert space, okay? And the states now, we'll use this notation, are just So if instead of H, usually we use anyway, we can use G or H is a group element associated to each H. Okay, so this is just E1. And so what is now the inner product? So the inner product is, so of course, on the tensor product, because we can really write H gamma as tensor product of each one edge Hilbert space. And so this is given by, if I consider two graphs, the same on the same graph here. Of course, then you need to define if you consider two functions on different graphs. But I'm not going to give you these details here, but of course, this is then defined. So if we have n edge, okay, so it's a product on, it's an integral, nth integral on the group, where you integrate and again, we use the R measure. And the R measure for each group element.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Question. Each of these, the H are SU2 group, the element?
SU2.
Yeah, so yeah. The F is not from SU2 to say, it's like SU2 times SU2 times SU2 n times.
No, because it's here it's a kind of, all right. You're right. All right. So here, where is,
And what does this number n mean?
So n is like if you consider a graph with n edges, okay? So you have one group element per edges.
N points.
N edges. So then it's... So usually you will have...
Sorry.
So if you have two edges, you see usually you have three endpoints, okay? So n is the number of edges.
Sorry.
So n here again is number of.
And what do you understand by graph in sigma? I mean, for example, you have round. This will be a graph in sigma.
Yeah.
Okay.
So any.
So you can do the graph you want, and you count the number of edges. And
yeah. Okay. So it's really any possible graph on your hypersurface.
Okay.
One question.
Yeah.
Why are the functions cylindrical? Or, why do they belong to this one?
So this is a definition when you talk about function defined on this in terms of this holonomy. We call them cylindrical function. Okay, and it's correspond to. And it also it's associated to when it's associated to graphs, okay? Because here you have this relation between the cylindrical function of generalized function, you really need to consider all possible graphs. Okay? So it's when function are associated, it's function defined in terms of a graph and a smooth function. Okay, this is
so we are defining there what is a cylindrical function or
yeah.
Okay. So it doesn't have anything to do with some cylindrical symmetry or anything like that.
No, then we will see that there are some symmetry because of the fact that we are using, indeed, holonomies, and maybe, I'm not sure it's related to, but no, yet it's a different, this is the definition of the cylindrical function here, okay? Yeah. And of course, from since it's just a tensor product of all this one Hilbert space, we can quickly define what is going to be the orthonormal basis. So this is quite, everything is quite straightforward from what we have seen for 1H. Because we really consider for the moment, since we don't have any constraint, all the edges are independent. In fact, we just connect them. There is no, and we're going to see that implementing the constraint is going to put some really constraint on what we can, how we can relate these edges. So here, it's just going to be obtained the same way by tensoring the basis function which are given by this element here for each h. And so really what you get here is that maybe it's more like the set of this object associated with gamma is going to define you the state associated to, or maybe again, yeah, is given just by E1 and then if you have again n edges,
the constraint will kill some of these. Because you said you mentioned something that the magnetic numbers,
yeah,
should
so
have some property. And
yeah, so for the moment, what you have, it's really each edge is you have a GMN, but coming from each edge. So you write that if now this is E1, and then you add E2 here, so here you see that at this edge, if depending on the orientation, you can get an N E2 or ME2, depending on your orientation, etc. And we are going to see that indeed the fact that then we are going to impose the constraint are going to constrain this. Okay? All these magnetic numbers together. And so, really, the kinematical Hilbert space that we have here is and again, you can, so it's a tensor product of all these square integral functions. So you can also see that as square integral function on G times N, where N is the number of edges, OK? OK, so this was just, then, of course, here I gave you the simple case because I consider inner product between two functions defined on the same graph. Then, of course, you have to deal with function defining on different graphs. But this, for example, so I posted and I sent you yesterday the homework where you have to read an article and more or less do the to review this article. So this article is, why do I have chosen this article? It's because it's really an article that you can, I think, understand everything from the lecture. So it's the only difference is going that instead of working with SU2, now you're going to work with a non-compact group, the Lorentzian group. So of course, you need to know a bit about, but it's explaining what is the representation of this Lorentzian group. But it's still useful for you because the Lorentzian group, as you know, is quite an important symmetry for in physics. So no, no, this is seems to be not working anymore.
You got it. I try to move it down and then up, I think.
What should I do?
Try to move the.
Yeah, no, but it's just that I don't have the usual.
Or the second one or the two. Ah, no, you don't have the option to go.
No, so maybe I should take manual. Ah, no. Now I have it. Okay. And so really in this article, everything we have done up to now is really summarized. And you, in particular, you will, so the definition of the kinematical Hilbert space and then the definition of the the definition of the length operator in this non-compact case. And so you will see in this article, it's a bit explained more in detail what the inner product when you consider two different graphs. Okay, so now we need to quantization of the Smith-Gauss constraint. But if you remember what is the expression of this Gauss constraint, something like this. Meaning that it's complicated, okay? We have a derivative here, so we don't quantize to have such an operator, it's not going to be easy. So we are going to find a quantization quite using an indirect way. So do you remember what is the action of the Gauss constraint? What is it? It's what we are going to use.
Generates rotations.
Yeah, so it generates the Gauss transformation, the internal rotation, very good. So what we are going to try, so we're going to use here an indirect way. And use indeed this interpretation, because the action of the Gauss constraint is quite simple. It's going to generate, especially on our variable, we really check that the definition of our variable were also motivated by the fact that we wanted a nice action of this Gauss gauge transformation. And so the fact that at the classical level, this Gauss constraint generates this internal rotation, we want to keep that in the quantum theory, okay? Because it's just a way, when we see this rotation, this means that instead of just the infinitesimal version, so the constraint, we look at less the exponentiated version of the constraint. Okay, here it's really the infinitesimal version. So what we're going to use is that we have a simple reaction of the Gauss constraint is simple here. And do you remember what is the gauge transformation of an holonomy? You have a question or you want to answer what?
No. I was trying to remember that. It was from the connection. I don't remember.
I'm going to do the drawing maybe. So we have H, which is defined on the path. I'm going to denote VS, the source vertex, and VT, the target vertex. Okay, this is an oriented edge again, where we have this holonomy here. And so anyone remember the transformation? Yeah, again?
And so it goes to J of the target vertex, H, and J of the source, J inverse of the source vectors.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so it's just by group. In fact, it's by just really group action from the left and from the right, okay? So this is the transformation of the holonomy, and we know that our state are expressed as a function of the holonomy, okay? States we consider. So, and we want to define state invariant under this gauge transformation. So what does it mean? This means that our state are going to transform as here I'm just considering for the moment for one edge, because then we're going to see that indeed if we want to have something non-trivial, we need anyway to consider several edges. So this is the transformation of our state. This means that here what we have it is really an action of by the left by this group element and the right action by the holonomy at the source vertex, the inverse, acting on where here is the left and right action of the group. So what we want to implement now is a projector on the subspace of states satisfying the Gauss constraint by what we are going to use is a group averaging. Okay? Yeah?
I might be missing something. What's S of T?
Sorry?
S of T.
S. Ah, sorry. Yeah.
B of
D.
Of
yeah. Ah, so we said starting and then it's V of S here. So B and S. Yeah, sorry, thanks. Okay, so it's the action at, so this is the source vertex and VT is the target vertex. Okay, so what we are going to use is define a projector on the subspace satisfying the Gauss constraint by using a group, what we call group averaging. Okay, so this is the method we are going to use. So you see that we don't really quantize directly this object, we really go to more the finite interpretation of this, the finite action of this Gauss constraint, which is the interpretation of this constraint in terms of SU2 internal transformation. And then we use that so the next step is to implement projector on the subspace of states satisfying the Gauss constraint by averaging over the group, so it's a group averaging method. SU2, so the group SU2 for both edges and edge. Okay, so for a state based on just one edge, what does it mean? This means we want to define something like this, a projector on our state by doing the group averaging where we are acting on the left and the right on our state and we're integrating over all okay, so this is what we call a group averaging. So now let's check what this means for just one edge, okay? So for one edge, this means that now, so I'm integrating here over two copies of the group. So for one edge, what do I have? I have, so this left action by G1, right action by G2 on my state, evaluated at the given group element H, and I'm integrating over G1, dG1, dG2. So I'm acting with this group action on my state. So what do I get? I get phi of E with, so by the left it's G1 times H. So here it's the inverse, since if you remember the definition I gave you of this left action. And so what can you say about this number? Do you remember that we are here using the R measure? So what is the important property of the R measure?
It's invariant.
By left and right action. So you see that here you could redefine your group element, okay, by G tilde, and then it's the same measure. So what is this number? This is just a constant, meaning it does not depend on any group element. Okay, so it's really a number here. So it's a constant, it's independent. If you want it, yeah, it's going to be independent of H because your H can be reabsorbed in your R measure using the invariance of your R measure. So this means that here, if you consider just one H, the solution space is quite trivial, okay? Because it's already, you just get constant number. So the solution space is going to become non-trivial if we consider several H's, okay? Meeting at one vertex. This is the next case. So here, solution space is non-trivial if you consider considering several edges meeting at one vertex. So let's just look at two edges and see if we can say something. So this means that you're going to consider a function and now, in fact, if you want to have an invariant function, you're going to consider function of the type where you consider the product because indeed, so now if you have G1, G2 by the gauge transformation, you're going to act at this H with H for this G1, this H characterized by G1, and H minus 1 for the H characterized by G2. So you see that here it's going to cancel out. So you're indeed going to have an invariant state over the picture. But so it's become to be interesting what you're going to get if you consider three H's. So let's see. What does it mean for a three-valent vertex now? So three-valent means that I'm considering one vertex with three edges. And here I'm going to consider, since everything has to be oriented, I'm going to consider, I need to specify which case I'm considering. So I'm going to consider outgoing with three outgoing edges. And in fact, in 3D gravity, it's really sufficient to work with three valent vertices at when we are at the gauge invariant level. And in fact, the vertices of valence greater than 3 can all be decomposed in terms of vertex of valence 3. Okay. And here, I want to generalize this for a vertex V. So now we look at, in fact, what is important is really to the Gauss constraint. You really add at the Gauss constraint at each vertices of your graph now, okay? It's what we can see from the way everything is acting. And so if I'm acting on a vertex V, it's going to be the left, the product, the tensor product of the left action for outgoing, now ingoing vertices. So here it's when E is such as V is equal to V, the target of V, okay? And then for the ingoing vertices, you will have a right action, okay? So here it's for the, so here it's labeled by E. And here it's E prime, and the E prime are such as V here for this V prime. So the V we consider has to be the source of your edge. Okay, so this means that here, E prime. Here I'm considering a vertex V, and I have many edges coming here. So you see that if it's in outgoing here, this means that V is the source vertex for your given edge. And when it's incoming, okay, then it's going to be the target. Here it's the T, so if this one is E1, V can be seen as VT of E1, okay? And here is the source vertex for this E prime one. And so here in our case, if we look just at three outgoing edges, it's going to be simplified a bit. So we want to look at this projector acting on my basis state given by the tensor product of GI, MI, and I, where here I go from 1 to 3. And where now, so I'm going to integrate over the H, and I'm going to act by right action because I'm just going looking at outgoing edges. So I'm on this case, at these cases, by the right action on E1, right action on E2, right action on E3, still acting on this state. Okay? And so now I need to figure out what I get and how it's going to. So as I already told you, you should expect that this is going to constrain the magnetic number, okay?
One question, why do we have all the right actions, the H? I'm kind of confused because when we introduce that, we distinguish like G1 and G2.
Yeah, so good question. So G1, E2, here. It's because here I was first focusing on edges, and now I turn the focus on one vertex. So here you see that here it's because on one edge,
yeah,
you have two vertices.
Ah.
Okay, so E1 and G2 were acting on, this one was for the source vertex, and this one for the target. The source vertex and the target vertex.
Okay.
Whereas here, you only have one vertex, so that's why you need to consider now the focus has to be not on edges, but on vertices for the Gauss constraint, is because you see that if when you consider one vertex, it's really going to be for many edges, even for all these edges, it's going to be the same group element which is going to appear, because it's going to be the G, because the gauge transformation here is really acting on the vertices, okay? So so this means that this G here that you have, GVT, is really associated to this vertex, okay? So this means that now if I have many other edges here, this guy is going to act on all these edges on these vertices, okay? So that's why now we only have one H left. It's because we are reacting on only these vertices. If I was really looking at these edges with their two vertices, okay, then I would have to add this group element at each of these vertices. But you see that then you really need to know how many edges you have, because to really understand how this H is going to act, okay, you need to know the number of vertices. Okay, so you need to have your complete graph. So that's why before I just focus on one edge, but if you have a graph made from one edge, it's too simple. The action is trivial. Okay. Okay, good question. So that's why we have only this H here. And so I think sort of just recall that above that the action, the right action here give in fact this, so it's like looking at the action of this flux variable, in fact, okay, this flux variable. So we have here the same decomposition. It's going to insert some of this. So maybe I need a bit more space. So let's just go here. So it's going to insert some matrix element. Okay. So it's going to be the sum of G1, P1, N1 times for each edges is going to insert a matrix element associated to each irreducible. So this irreducible representation are the one associated to each edge, okay? And if you remember, it's going to, so it's leaving invariant the n, but it's acting on this m magnetic number here, because we are, so here, since it's outgoing in the case, so the case we are considering is this outgoing edges. So G1, and here I have M1, then M2 coming from with G2, and here I have M3, G3, and if you represent the end, the other end point, here of course you would get N1, N2, N3, but you see that here it's going to act on this three magnetic number here. Oh, maybe no, it's the other way, it's the N. What I'm saying is the M. Yeah, it's the N here. Sorry.
So the M is left invariant?
Yeah. Okay, so P1 and P3 and 3 of H. And then now you're acting on the tensor. You still have the tensor product of G, E, I, M, I, P, I. Okay, because I'm just focusing on this vertex, so it's just like it's just going to give me something on this and variable here. Okay, and so what is this? And here I'm summing over this PI. So P1, P2, P3. So you see that now the so I'm going to integrate over H, and the H dependence is only on this in this group element here that I have here. So what do I get? I need some space. So here you're going to get, what is this object that you're going to get that is going in fact to characterize, give you a quantum number associated to each vertex of your graph. So you see that for each edges you have this pin label, okay? And for each vertices we're going to see that we're going to get an intertwiner. But in fact with this kind of procedure you're going to miss the geometrical interpretation. But here, what is really going to tell you is that you can see that as, so when you have three edges, it's dual to a triangle. And indeed, what is going to tell you, the Gauss constraint is really to tell you that you have a triangle, like closed one. It's going to close if you have the, because you know that this is dual to a curve with a given length. We have seen that the length is characterized by this J. And if you now impose the Gauss constraint, it's going to tell you that these three edges with their three lengths close and form a triangle. So you really see the geometry emerging, the quantum geometry and discrete geometry emerging from this picture, okay? But so let's do, so I don't know if you're familiar with recoupling theory in SU2, but so from recoupling theory, this is just a well-known formula. You know that here, if you integrate over the group, three matrix element what you get is a well-known symbol, which is called the 3J Wigner 3J symbol. Have you heard about this symbol already or not yet? This 3J symbol, do you know that? So it's a product of two, so G1, G2, G3. So this is really just the algebraic picture. If you really want the geometric picture, then it's another kind of interpretation. But so these symbols are the Wigner. And even if you never heard of that with this name, you're in fact familiar with them because it's related to the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. So here's the definition. Of this symbol is given in terms of, so you have some sine G2 maybe, some dimension, so here it's 2J3 plus 1, which is the dimension of the J3 representation, and here you have the Clebsch-Gordan between so you know that the coefficient I get from, it's the transformation coefficient between the tensor product of two angular momentum and the coupled basis with quantum number. And you also know, so this is the Clebsch-Gordan. And you also know that you have some triangular inequality which has to be satisfied in order to get a non-zero Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. So here it's exactly the same. It's why I'm telling you that implementing the Gauss constraint at the level of this magnetic number is going to constrain them in a way that if you want to have a non-zero coefficient here, they need to satisfy some relation, non-trivial relation between them. And at the geometric picture, it really tells you that this edge is characterizing a dual edge with a given length, which is discrete. And what is doing the Gauss constraint is really gluing these edges together and to form, when you have three of them, it's really it's a closed triangle, okay? Meaning that it's this relation between the J that you get from the Clebsch-Gordan, the triangular inequalities between these are really the inequality you need to, that the length of your triangle need to satisfy to really close as a triangle. Okay, so it's really related to that. And you could check that this, so now I'm going to give you the result, but just another point is that this is really a proper projector. Okay, so if you act, you have that the square of this, if you act a second time, it's really like acting on anyone. So it's really a proper, what we call a projector. So now what do we get here on what is the result? Acting on V. Maybe I changed notation. On our basis. So here I'm starting with this unconstrained basis. Okay? So I'm just talking about edges. We know what is the basis for each edge, I take the tensor product and then I'm acting on this with this constraint and I'm going to get some restriction. And so here, what do I get? I can put that out. So the one which is important is the one depending on this P, because you're summing over. This one can be just seen as a kind of normalization factor. And now, three, and you get so G1, I1, M, I, P, I. And so if now, because we have the fact that this is really a projector and also some you have the relation between the Wigner 3J symbol, you get it's normalized. In fact, you have this relation, so I can just give it to you. M3, where you sum over the M by and this object is here equal to 1. Okay, so the normalized invariant state based on the three edges with source vertex V is going to be just given to invariant under rotation at V is given by this. So I'm just concluding on that. And then tomorrow we are going to implement on top of that the flatness constraint, and you will get your, you will get the, what we call the physical state. So just now we are just at, so what is normalized? Invariant. So under rotation at V at the vertex V. So a state based, here we just looked at state based on three edges. Okay, but in 3D, this is really just what we need because every other vertices can be really decomposed in three valent vertices. So with source vertex here. V, what you get is this state. Of course, which is decomposed on the basic. So P1, P2, P3. And then here, you're tensor product of GY, MI, PI. Okay, so this is, and this gives you a unique when you have a three valent vertex, but since then every vertices can be decomposed in terms of three valent, this really gives you when it's normalized. Up to normalization, a unique state. Okay, so this state here is unique, and just let, and here what we call, this is going to characterize P1, P3 is what we call the intertwiner, and this is really the quantum number which is going to characterize each vertices of your graph. So now on each edges you have this spin number, and each vertices you have this intertwiner. So this means that at this stage you have states which are invariant under the Gauss constraint. So usually when we talk about kinematical Hilbert space in loop quantum gravity, we already talk about state invariant under the Gauss constraint, okay? Because it's an easy one to implement in the, even in four dimension. So when you are talking about the spin network state, because the spin network state is really this, so now it's a graph, oriented graph and decorated graph, where at each edges you're going to get a spin representation, at each vertices you're going to get an intertwiner, and usually we say that this is the kinematical basis of loop quantum gravity, so it's a basic excitation of space. And usually we talk about the spin network, but they're already invariant under the gauge transformation. Okay, so this means that one of the constraints has already been implemented. Okay.